and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Thursday, July the 23rd of 2020. And in this Word Magazine, number 170, I'm going to be offering a review slash reaction to a recent book that I completed reading. The book is by Elaine Pagels. It is a memoir titled Why Religion, subtitled A Personal Story, published by HarperCollins in 2018. It is 235 pages in length. And I read this book over the course of the past week. We're in the midst of the Riddle Family Annual Summer Reading Contest that begins on June 1 and ends August 1. And we read feverishly, and I picked this memoir up and read it. And I thought it might be interesting to do, again, a review slash reaction of it. I would describe this book as a selective memoir of a New Age neo-Gnostic academic. Elaine Pagels, who was born in 1943, is now in her late 70s. She is a professor of religion at Princeton University. Early in her career, going back to her graduate student days, she was involved in the translation and the publication and the academic study of a group of documents that came to be known as the Nag Hammadi Library. This was a cache of ancient Gnostic and pseudo-Christian texts, including the famous Gospel of Thomas, a collection of supposed lost sayings of Jesus that were discovered in the Egyptian desert in 1945 and then slowly began to be disseminated, translated, and studied by scholars. Some people hold to the theory that there was a nearby monastery there and the monks were told to get rid of the sub-Orthodox and non-Orthodox writings, and one of them, rather than destroy these writings, or several of them, went and hid them, and then they were uncovered again in the 20th century, and so there's been a renewal of interest in them. Some of these documents were known from being cited in the writings of early Christian apologists, but for some of them, there weren't extant manuscripts of these Gnostic writings until the Nag Hammadi discovery. Well, anyways, Pagels, as a graduate student, was among some of the first, along with her professors who were guiding her in doing her doctoral work, was among the first to read and translate some of these. Then she made her mark by popularizing the Gnostic writings. She wrote a best-selling, popular-level book titled The Gnostic Gospels in 1979. And this introduced sort of Gnosticism to a wider audience. She's a bit like Bart Ehrman. You know, Bart Ehrman does academic work, and then every couple of years he produces some book on a popular level, and some of these become New York Times bestsellers. And basically, Pagels has done the same thing. I'm guessing, for example, that if you're familiar with the novel by Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, that presents, you know, Orthodox Christians as the villains and Gnosticism as some sort of progressive, you know, egalitarian, noble version of Christianity that was suppressed by the mean old Orthodox. I'm guessing that Dan Brown probably picked up a lot of his admiring ideas about Gnosticism by reading Elaine Pagels' The Gnostic Gospels. Pagels, I mentioned a parallel with Ehrman, and I think she and Ehrman and a host of others that are in the Modern Academy today, including many who are involved in text criticism, they labor under the influence of the German critic Walter Bauer and his groundbreaking work, Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. The German original came out in 1934, then it was translated into English in 1971, and this book argued that Orthodox Christianity was just one stream among many early Christianities, plural, and that it just happened to be the stream that eventually got the upper hand and then suppressed all the others. And so really a lot of late 20th, early 21st century academic study of religion sort of labors under this Walter Bauer thesis. So Pagels, after she did her graduate work and had this popular book on the Gnostic Gospels in 1979, every couple of years she would come out with another popular level book. She came out with a book called Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, subtitled Sex and Politics in Earliest Christianity. Let me just look and see what year that came out. That came out, I think, in 1989. That book came out. And then in 1995, she came out with a book titled The Origin of Satan, How Christians Demonized Jews, Pagans, and Heretics. In 2003, she came out with a book titled Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. And much more recently, in 2012, she came out with a book titled Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. And like I said, these popular level books, like Ehrman's popular level books, have an undercurrent that sort of goes against traditional Christianity. The Adam, Eve, and the Serpent book on sex and politics in early Christianity, is going to talk about how the Orthodox Christians were sexually repressive and they were anti-woman, as opposed to the enlightened Gnostics. The book on the origin of Satan, is going to talk about how the early Christians were anti-Semitic and how they suppressed, pagans and those that they deemed to be heretics. And the book on the Gospel of Thomas, obviously, is going to talk about how the Gospel of Thomas has these wonderful esoteric insights into Christianity that the Orthodox attempted to suppress. So anyways, that's just a little bit about Pagel's career. I might add, just before I start this going sort of beginning to end on the memoir, that she also went through a lot of difficult personal things within her life that she discusses in this memoir. She lost a son who was born with a defective heart condition when the child was just 6 years old. And then just over a year later after that, she lost her husband in a tragic hiking, climbing accident in Colorado. And the basic gist of this memoir, Why Religion, is that she explains how she went through these difficulties, and it was essentially her sort of New Age Gnostic faith, if I could put the word faith in scare quotes, that helped her cope with and overcome these tragedies, these personal tragedies that she lived through. The title of the book, again, Why Religion? She says this comes from a question. She gives one anecdote of being at a party and someone asked her the question, why religion? And so it was kind of a question of why have you devoted your career to the academic study of religion? But then she sort of morphs off that to also think about the question, why religion? Why is she religious? Why is she a religious person? And we'll talk more here at the end about what sort of religion it is exactly that she has embraced and advocates. So let me turn now and just go through a little bit about what I picked up from the memoir. So the story begins with her childhood. She grew up in Palo Alto, California. She grew up in a rather privileged middle-class family. Her maiden name was Heasey, Elaine Heasey, and she describes her father as an atheistic scientist. He, according to her, had come from a repressive Calvinist home. Of course, if it was a Calvinist home, it had to be repressive. She describes her mother as an emotionally distant homemaker. So she doesn't have a lot of really positive things to say about her parents, unfortunately. They're presented as sort of cold and emotionally distant from her. It's always almost presented as sort of like a rebellion in the opening pages. She describes how as a 15-year-old, some friends invited her to go to, of all things, a Billy Graham crusade at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. And while she was there, she had a walk the aisle type of experience where she prayed a prayer and thought of herself as being a Christian. She mentions that she attended the Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto. She never mentions being baptized, but, you know, she sort of said she identified as, you know, from this age for a few years as being a born-again Christian. I'm not sure if the Peninsula Bible Church, I think, is the church where Ray Steadman was the pastor, may have been the pastor while she was there, but he's not mentioned in the book. But I know there's at least one audio archive of a lot of sermons from Ray Steadman. He was a popular sort of evangelical, hip evangelical pastor of that era, 1960s, 1970s, and on into the 80s. One thing about this faith, though, was, again, that it was very fragile, a supposed faith. And she goes on to tell in the memoir about how a friend of hers died in a car accident. And she says in the memoir that some of her Christian friends supposedly said that this fellow who died was in hell because he was Jewish. Somehow I'm a bit skeptical about that. I wouldn't doubt that her Christian friends might have wondered about his spiritual state, about his eternal destiny. They might have said, you know, if he wasn't a Christian, then, you know, he didn't have the promise of salvation, didn't have the promise of heaven. I'm doubtful they said that he went to hell because he was Jew, that, you know, just some sort of outright anti-Semitism. At any rate, Pagels writes on page 15, "I left the church and never went back." So she had a short-termed, you know, born-again phase. And in this way, she draw another parallel to Bart Ehrman, because Bart Ehrman also famously claimed that he was an evangelical, had a born-again experience, even went to Moody Bible College and then deconverted. And so Pagels was a much less long-lived supposed conversion, but she deconverted even as a teenager. And just reading this again, I'm reminded of the problems of superficial evangelism, drive-by evangelism. You know, what good did it do Bart Ehrman, or what good did it do Elaine Pagels to have them sort of be false professors and lead to spiritual confusion in their lives? Anyways, one of the interesting anecdotes that she mentions in this memoir is that one of her childhood friends was Jerry Garcia, who would go on to form the band The Grateful Dead. And so Pagels was a friend of Garcia's growing up. This indicates that she was very much a child of the 60s, you know, the early 60s, and sort of grew into young adulthood in that sort of countercultural era. She did her undergraduate degree at Stanford. And then she describes how she sort of randomly entered into the field of the study of religion. She actually applied, she says, to five different graduate schools in five different disciplines, and just so happened was accepted at Harvard. And she went there to study under the New Testament professor, Christer Stendhal. And I remember him from the article that's often cited. He wrote an article about Paul's conversion and or prophetic call in the book of Acts. And I think he called it Paul and the Introspective Consciousness of the West. But anyway, Stendhal was there at Harvard at that time. She points out in the memoir that her acceptance was delayed because she was a woman and the administration was uncertain as to whether, you know, she would actually complete the degree. She cites the acceptance note. Certainly wouldn't be something that would be sent out today. And she also talks about her graduate studies. She sort of shares a kind of Me Too story when she claims that the respected Lutheran New Testament scholar who taught at Harvard named Helmut Kester basically sexually harassed her when she was babysitting for his family one evening. And she even claims that other people had this experience with him, and he was known on campus as Kester the Molester. You can see this on page 26. I looked it up, and Kester died in 2016, so he wasn't alive when this memoir came out. I notice it's noted on his Wikipedia page that he was accused of sexual harassment. It's kind of sad he wasn't around to defend his reputation against these charges. And I did notice on YouTube that Kester's memorial service at Harvard Divinity School is still posted to YouTube, interestingly enough. So the charge hasn't resulted in that being pulled down yet. So she completed her graduate study at Harvard. As I said, that's where she sort of was introduced to the Nag Hammadi writings and made it the study of Gnosticism in early Christianity as one of the focus points of her work. And at the end, she describes leaving Harvard, having completed her course of study there, with viewing Christianity as follows. She says she saw Christianity as, quote, a huge, messy heap of traditions, stories, images, and practices, end quote. That's pages 30 and 31. So she comes out thinking the heroes of early Christianity were not the Orthodox, not those who upheld what we consider to be Orthodox views, but the heroes, the real heroes, were the heretics, those who promoted heresy. And she defines heresy as choice. You know, they were open-minded. They were willing to, have a wider variety of choices. She enthusiastically describes herself at this point in her life as embracing the fact that she was religious, while at the same time rejecting the idea that that religion has to do with a defined set of beliefs as traditional Christianity holds. So she likes religion, but she likes non-doctrinal religion. So after graduating, Pagels went off to New York City, where she taught religion at Barnard College. And again, it's kind of interesting to read this memoir and to think about who teaches religion in public universities. And so it's very insightful to know about the type of people who are teaching academic religion. She eventually married a theoretical physicist named Heinz Pagels. And that's, of course, where she gets her name, Elaine Pagels, as she changes her name. Sort of an interesting traditional choice, I guess, given her sort of non-traditional views in many other ways. As I noted, she published in 1979 the Gnostic Gospels book. At one point in the memoir, she talks about the reviews that came out on this book. It was widely reviewed. And she, in particular, particularly notes some of the negative reviews that came from some of the older, more traditional scholars, including the Roman Catholic Raymond Brown and the Roman Catholic Joseph Fitzmyer. And she notes that Fitzmyer in particular was very vicious in his review. Maybe want to look up the review. I haven't done it yet. I want to look up Fitzmyer's review and read it. She says that some people urged her to sue him for libel. The review was so cutting. And also she had briefly gone to Oxford and studied with the church historian Henry Chadwick, who is Anglican, and he also gave it a negative review. And so it's interesting that she didn't take those reviews and think, you know, maybe they were right about something. Maybe I've overemphasized the influence of Gnosticism over against Orthodox Christianity. But no, she simply took these negative reviews by these more respected and older colleagues as just them being narrow-minded. So she talks about on the personal level at this point, she wanted to have a child, and she and her husband were not able to conceive. And she also begins to talk about her dabbling in sort of New Age, non-traditional religious practices. So she was dealing with not being able to conceive. So she engaged, she tells us on page 59, in a pagan fertility ritual with some feminist friends. She did it eventually conceive, and she describes, you know, the birth of her son, and then immediately he was diagnosed with having a significant heart defect, and it was inoperable, and that he would eventually not be able to survive. And it is gut-wrenching. I think any parent will be moved, even somebody you disagree greatly with regard to the faith. On a human level, you know, we can feel sorrow and sympathy for her as she went through this. She did find out just after the birth of her son that she received a MacArthur Genius Grant in light of what was considered to be the value of her book on Gnosticism. And this was timely in that it enabled her to devote her time to the care of her son in his early years. Again, she comes across as a child of the 60s, a New Ager, a counterculturalist. She describes experimenting with taking LSD on page 41, exploring same-sex attraction on page 49. And along the way with that, she talks about this great insight she had that, you know, the biblical description of man and woman and marriage as a one flesh union, Genesis 2:24 and Genesis, that was less revelation, she saw it, and more a tool of social and cultural control. So this was her great insight. She also talked about dabbling in magic to treat her depression, page 79. And dealing with the stresses of her son, she talks about battling addiction to alcohol and attending AA meetings on page 63, becoming addicted to smoking on page 80. And again, we can feel with her on a human level, but we could say that she was, it seems, you know, from our perspective, that she's sort of looking for answers and love and guidance in all the wrong places. And as I read through this, and particularly her embracing all these New Age practices, as somebody who is, you know, a credentialed scholar of religion and then seeking all these esoteric, non-traditional religious practices, I thought of the saying that's attributed to G.K. Chesterton, that the problem when people abandon traditional Christianity is not that they will believe in nothing, but that they will believe in anything. With respect to sort of her religious views, she talks a lot about having sort of visions and dreams. She talks about, after the birth of her son, a dark figure whom she later identifies as Satan, you know, appearing. After the death of her son and the death of her husband, she talks about feeling their presence and sort of sensing that they were leaving the body and coming back to the body. And she describes other sort of esoteric experiences that she supposedly had. And again, it's just kind of very strange to read about. As already noted, she did go through the gut-wrenching death of her son, Mark, at age 6. And she and her husband had also adopted a daughter. And then after the son's death, they, oddly enough, worked with a Christian, sounds like a Presbyterian adoption agency to adopt their children. I guess there aren't any Gnostic adoption agencies that I know of. But anyways, they adopted a son after the death of their biological son. And then, as already noted, sort of tragedy upon tragedy, a little over a year after the death of her son, she and her family were in Colorado. Her husband went to a gathering of physicists every summer at a retreat conference center in Colorado. Her husband went out for a hike with a colleague, and he was an experienced hiker and climber. But he took a tragic fall, and it was even more grotesque. He fell, and it dismembered his body on impact, and it was just a terrible thing for anybody to go through, and you feel for her. And this understandably sent her into another sort of emotional tailspin after the death of her son. And again, a lot of the point of the book seems to be that she was only able to emerge from this dark episode with the help of the Gnostic spirituality that she had encountered and embraced from her studies. Traditional Christianity within this memoir, both subtly and overtly, is presented as an object of disdain. At one point, she talks about the Orthodox theologians Augustine of Hippo and Athanasius, and she says of them, quote, that they set off, quote, a long and horrific history of pogroms, lynching, legal restrictions, even genocide, first against Jews and dissident Christians called heretics, then against infidels, and more recently against tribal people branded as Satan worshipers, end quote, page 161. Particularly odious to pagans is the traditional view of the atoning death of Christ, as articulated, for example, by the Apostle Paul in the canonical letters of Paul. She cites 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5, where Paul writes about Christ having died for our sins according to the Scriptures, having been buried, had been raised again the third day according to Scriptures, and having appeared to Peter and then to the 12. And she says she doesn't like, you know, this Pauline view of the wrath of God being satisfied by the death of Christ on the cross. She says she much prefers the Paul who is presented in the Gnostic Gospel of Truth, who appears not as a preacher of the cross and of the resurrection, but as a teacher of secret wisdom. At one point later in the book, on page 204, she talks about Jesus being best understood as a sort of psychiatrist. And so it's a sort of a view of Jesus like the Gnostics that she so admires, where the focus is not on his death and resurrection, not on the gospel, but on the sort of teachings, the words and the esoteric teachings, particularly found hidden in the Gnostic writings. Those who are interested, I know some people who listen to this podcast are interested in text criticism, might be intrigued, as I was, by her rather extended reflections on the ending of Mark and how they fit in with her theology. This is on pages 169 to 174. And perhaps unsurprisingly, she seems to really revel in the idea that Mark originally ended at Mark 16:8. She thinks this provides a sort of loose and open-ended account of Jesus' life. Of course, this would mean there would be a gospel with no resurrection appearances. And so she is all in for embracing the so-called shorter ending of Mark. Oddly enough, despite her anti-Christian bias, Pagels also describes various interactions, particularly with more liberal mainline forms of Christianity. She talks about visiting Trappist monasteries. She, at one point, talks about having received an invitation to, quote, give a sermon, end quote, in an Episcopal church in Aspen, Colorado. And I looked on YouTube, there's a video there you can find where she very recently was asked to be a guest preacher and to deliver a Lenten sermon at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., where, of course, she talked about Gnostic writings as opposed to the canonical Gospels. Her worldview also leads her not only to reject Christianity, but it also seems to reject sort of Western culture, the Western culture that was shaped by Christianity, and a Western culture that sort of produced a person like Elaine Pagels. You know, she has been given privileges that have been only known by an elite few, to teach at a major university, to receive all these grants and so forth. And yet she looks at this world when she's benefited, been blessed by Christianity and seems to look at it with disdain. There's one part that seemed, it's sad, but it seems, you know, also, you know, ironic. She talks about this article she read that praised the way a certain tribe, the Ingot tribe, I-N-G-O-T, tribe of the Philippines, praises the way they express their anger and their grief by headhunting. And the implication, she's talking about her own anger and grief after the loss of her son and her husband, and, you know, why do we have this, why do Westerners have to carry their grief within? Why can't we openly express our grief the way this headhunter tribe does in the Philippines? And I was just reading this thinking, well, I'm guessing that the victims of the Ingot tribe would not necessarily agree that the Western way of dealing with anger and grief is somehow inferior to what headhunters choose to do with their anger and grief. But anyways, one chapter ends with an interesting, what I consider to be very self-indulgent conclusion. She writes on page 183, quote, "Many people raised even nominally, as I was, within Christian culture, find Christianity's traditional exclusion of anything outside its boundaries too confining. And while finding truth for ourselves is difficult, often elusive, some of us can't avoid the challenge. Instead, we dive in," end quote. And I just feel like that is just, again, very arrogant, very self-indulgent, as if, you know, she is some sort of heroic searcher for the truth, and that people who hold to the confines of traditional Christianity aren't interested in throwing themselves into the search for the truth. I find that to be self-indulgent. The memoir ends with Pagel's description of her receiving an honorary doctorate from her alma mater, Harvard University, and interestingly enough, the day she received her honorary degree, Oprah Winfrey was also honored by receiving an honorary degree from Harvard. She talks about how her now grown adopted children were in attendance, and so that's the way the book sort of ends. I called it earlier a selective memoir, as any memoir in her defense has to be, can't tell everything. But I did look up her Wikipedia page after reading the memoir, and I was surprised to find that it noted there that she had a second marriage. She was married to a Columbia law professor in 1995. They were married for a decade, divorced him in 2005, according to Wikipedia. But there is not one mention of that second marriage in the memoir. Although her ex-husband's name appears one time, I saw, in a list in the closing acknowledgments on page 216. So this memoir was an interesting read. Pagels is no doubt a very, very intelligent woman. But the book shows, I think, the topsy-turvy world of the academic study of religion and of early Christianity in particular. Particularly the fact that it's a world where the champions of orthodoxy, like Irenaeus, are now the villains. And it's the heretics, like the Gnostic Valentinian, who are the heroes. And unfortunately, I think Pagels is more the rule than the exception. When I talk to students who are thinking about going to college, I usually tell them to be very careful about taking religion classes in a secular, and sadly, even in an evangelical university, because sadly, even some of the evangelical professors may be more like Pagels than one might think. This book, I think, also shows the spiritual void that results when one rejects traditional faith, traditional Christianity, and attempts to replace it with a hyper-individualistic, hyper-anti-traditional New Age ethic. And one of the funny things was, for somebody who's so intelligent and so self-aware, she doesn't, I don't think, seem to be aware of the fact that I think even probably her reading of Gnosticism seems to be deeply influenced by her own 1960s countercultural type of outlook. She praises, for example, the Gnostics for being progressive egalitarians, but she doesn't say anything about their frequent expressions of misogyny. I've long been struck by saying 114 in the Gospel of Thomas, the last saying recorded of what we have from the Gospel of Thomas. It reads, Simon Peter said to them, make Mary leave us, for females don't deserve life. And then Jesus responds, look, I will guide her to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. Not sure how Pagels deals with that. I need to go back and look at her Beyond Belief book on the Gospel of Thomas. That doesn't exactly seem to be a very progressive view. In fact, the traditional Christian view has a very high view of the spiritual equality of men and women. Take what Paul says in Galatians 3:28, for example. But oddly enough, in the reimagining of Gnosticism in modern academia, they are the progressives, and it's the Orthodox who are narrow-minded and confining. Anyways, I was thinking about the title of her book, Why Religion, and I thought of maybe deviously retitling it, rechristening it, Why Heresy. In the end, Pagel's story is, I think, a warning and a reminder about why we must, as Jude says in Jude 3, earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. So, anyways, there's my review reaction to Elaine Pagel's memoir, Why Religion? A personal story. I hope this has been helpful and interesting and edifying for those who are listening. And I will look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.